Welcome to Lessons for Life. My guest today is Jesse Shemin. Welcome. It's an honor to have you on the show. And Jesse is a London-based technology entrepreneur known for founding the leading AI dubbing startup, Papercup, and more recently joining the Scale AI to help build AI products in the UK. Wow. We are the AI generation. It's an honor to have you. And when I see somebody that is in AI already for many, many years, that shows me you're a man of vision.
Wouldn't go that far, but I'll take some of the credit.
It's really an honor. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this AI in the first place.
Brief history on me is that I studied finance and economics at NYU's undergrad business school called Stern, where you're basically told to go into investment banking. I started off at Credit Suisse and classic junior year internship, but it just wasn't for me. It was soulless. I really didn't like it. I was always tinkering with computers and playing around with things and saw my father, who's a physician, really build a lot on his own for his own private practice, including using hardware and software. And so I was always intrigued by that and always, I think, inspired by how much he was just self-motivated. And so my first job was at Deloitte in the UK, where I co-launched their ventures arm, which is basically a technology incubator, first equity investment arm. It sounds very glamorous, but it was also just hard to convince these equity partners to part ways with cash that could have been in their pocket and put into fledgling startups.
We also, as rabbis, we also have a difficulty convincing people to invest in community. So I know what you mean.
Exactly. So I did that for a bit and then realized I just wanted to build something from the ground up. And so that's when I joined what is currently called Entrepreneurs First, which is a talent accelerator that basically pulls together a lot of people with technical backgrounds from Cambridge and Oxford and elsewhere. They usually index on AI and whatnot. And that's where I met my co-founder at the time. We came up, he had the technical chops. And the idea was to say, how can you use synthetic voices in a multilingual setting and make them understandable in any language? And what application would be really enticing for that is videos. Because if you could, dubbing was prohibitively expensive. So if you can use AI to automatically translate videos with a human in the loop correction, then all of a sudden you can make billions of hours of video watchable in any language. Watch Sky News, but hear it in Spanish. That was the dream. I think we were too early for our time because this is also pre-large language models and a lot of the what people consider AI today, even though it's still machine learning and AI. But
that's amazing. So the olden days, we have a movie that comes out. They used to have an entire team that works on dubbing the movie. Nowadays, what stage, what year was this that things started to change?
Well, traditional dubbing, the way it works is you get translators, voice artists, video editors, post-production teams that basically take an original source video, produce the translated script, and then have to go to studios to actually record it. If you have multiple characters, then you have to get multiple different character voice artists in studio to actually record them, post-edit and master it, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea was if you can, the most human intensive and laborious part was using the human voice artists, which are also quite expensive. Now, our principal thesis was, okay, that will always apply to the top echelon of movies. That could be a Netflix premiere series like Stranger Things, and they should use humans because there's a lot of artistic performance or things like Squid Game. But because it was prohibitively expensive, it meant that most video that was produced, forget from Warner Brothers or Netflix, but you could be a YouTube creator or you could be somebody from Sky News or BBC or ESPN or NBA or NFL. You're producing so much video content, but virtually none of it was translated. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we wanted to apply AI to say, well, let's combine human verifiers with AI to produce a baseline with AI that then humans can course correct and then release so that people can watch another.
Any idea what's the power in the costs for a company or for a person? How much money have you saved people, let's say, when it comes to using that AI alternative? It's incredible the efficiency that's happening over here.
Yes, there are wildly different costs. A premiere movie could go for $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 an hour, whereas we were charging roughly $1,200 an hour. But that cost is probably compressed quite a lot. What also matters is speed, right? So Sky News has very timely evergreen content, mm-hmm. or Bloomberg. And so if they wanted to produce that in another language and they sent that off to a localization company, it could take days or even a week for them to turn around. That's not sustainable because if you're writing something about the price of Bitcoin that dropped, then you need to cover that in that moment, in that day. Whereas we could actually turn around those translations in a matter of hours, which is what allowed the content to actually live and breathe in Latin America and elsewhere. and still have the timeliness.
And would people, obviously they'd notice the dubbing because people like to be spoken to at their own local language. Maybe would they notice this is, let's say, coming from America rather than South America?
I mean, originally our voices sounded so robotic that a good portion of the comments would identify that it was a synthetic voice. But our philosophy was it's better to have content translated into your mother tongue with a robotic voice than not even have the chance to consume it in your own language. And even still today, it's still a struggle to get what's called prosody, which is this idea of creating very emotive and expressive voices. Really hard to do that with a synthetic voice. And that's why it's actually quite challenging to say, okay, well, AI has made all of this progress it has today, but if you look at all of Amazon Prime Video or if you look at Netflix or Sky News, is it all translated into 50 languages? Not just because of cost, it's not just because of translation accuracy, but also because it's still really difficult to capture the complexity of human emotion in a synthetic voice. Mm-hmm. And we saw that.
It's kind of that you get to a certain, you can do so much, let's say 70, 80% of the idea, 90%, but the last 10% is what can take a decade to actually rectify.
Very true. Although it still took us quite a while to even get to the state where we wanted to be able to translate for an NBC or a Telemundo or a Burger. So eventually did get there, probably not at the speed that we wanted to. And even the end wasn't exactly the type of outcome that we wanted, but it was still a lot of...
And so you started there. What year was that? So
we started it in 2017, and then we closed the transaction. My team joined Scale in June of this
year. Wow. Okay. Busy. So yeah. At what age were you at 2017 when you started it up?
I was 27.
That's a big jump. So you moved from Deloitte straight into, you just left and you said, okay, let's do this. Obviously you had the background. These other people that you're mentioning, they were out of university or they were also in work?
A lot of the people might've had some startup experience beforehand or maybe worked at one of the hyperscalers or whatever. But yes, for the most part, this was definitely the first venture. By the way, you have no idea what you're doing. You hope to learn for the better.
So this is the famous question that a lot of students, a lot of working people have. Everyone's got ideas and they want to bring it to fruition. And you're a man that's been in a job. You've moved, you made that leap. At what stage, what helps you to make the decision to make the leap? When does a person, given your experience, make that kind of leap? Of course, every person is different, but what general advice can you give when a person is thinking, okay, this is a great idea. I really want to make it happen. Of course, they have to be determined and they have to put in, you know, the work and the effort and they have to have the knowledge, but they think that they can go ahead. What makes you make the leap and what are the hurdles that they can expect if they already expect it from now, you know, before they make the leap, then when it comes, it's much easier to deal with.
I think ideas are cheap, right? If you've thought of an idea, I would be absolutely shocked if there weren't at least another 100 people around the globe who have similarly thought of that idea. And so everything really does come down to execution, to actually doing something about it. You need a bias to action. That's one. The second principle that I would say is that it's usually easier to start something in your life where your risk tolerance is higher the younger you are. Mm-hmm. So that's a second point, because now I have family, I have kids and my wife that depend on me, that I absolutely love and adore, but I have to consider them when I think about whenever I want to
be the priority.
Yeah, the priority. And then thirdly, I would say is that there's never a perfect moment and you are never actually ready. There can't be. And if you've waited to that moment where everything crystallizes, I'd argue you've waited far too late. You have to be willing to take risk. You have to embrace the discomfort. You have to live in uncertainty. Because building a new venture is the idea of embracing uncertainty and figuring out how to navigate it.
There's a famous joke that I say to the young generation when it's a bit, you know, dating is not so simple nowadays. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the guys, specifically the guys, they like to hold back a little bit. So I said there was once a guy in America who had a big swimming pool and he gathered everybody together and he said, listen, guys, whoever makes it from this end of the swimming pool to the other end of the swimming pool within... You know, the first person at the end of the day, here's a briefcase, $1 million. Everybody starts to gather. There's only one catch. What's the catch? Inside the swimming pool, there's a little like shark. Okay. And the shark is swimming around. So everybody, you know, people, they said, I'm a good swimmer. I can do it. Six or seven people turn up, $1 million. They're standing over there. And the guy says, when I say three, then you jump in and you go. He says one, two. And just as before he says three, suddenly one guy's jumped in and everyone's looking and he's swimming, 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 swimming. And the shark is going and he's swimming, swimming, swimming. He's swimming. He reaches the end and he makes it. He gets out. He's panting. He's panting. The guy said, listen, I didn't say three, but that's the best swim I've ever seen. You get the $1 million. Just got one question. What made you do it? You know, how? So he says, listen, I just want to know, who's the fool that pushed me in? Who's the guy that pushed me in the first place? Right. Like, he didn't really want to go, you know, he wasn't. But sometimes we need the leap in order to get the, you know, reward. And that's what you're saying. And that's really what separates the heroes when we're talking about the people that are actually making those decisions when it's difficult out there. So yeah, I think that's beautiful.
And I would probably add one final principle, which is that whatever idea you start with, I would also be very surprised if that is the idea that you end up with, right? Because we tend to convince ourselves in our minds and come up with certain hypotheses. Let's just say, I think there should be an app to share home tools so that you don't need to go and buy a power drill. Okay, sounds interesting. Like my neighbor probably isn't, it has low utility. There could be high supply across a dense area. It seems like this should actually be a good idea. But you only really prove out your thesis once you actually go out and test it and go knock on doors and see if people want it. Also, just figuring out if people actually want what you have is the most insightful thing that you can do. And you'll likely pivot. Maybe it's not home power tools, but it ends up being pet walking in your area, whatever it might be. But you'll only discover that if you actually venture out and start something.
Mm-hmm. So be prepared to pivot, basically, because look at Amazon. They were the greatest American companies. They started up in the garage about books. And how many people nowadays are buying the books? Or it's more about the Amazon Prime, et cetera. It's completely pivoted.
Well, Jeff Bezos would say, and I probably do buy it, is that that was his
initial dream
product as part of the marketplace. And then the expectation was always to add on product categories. If anything, I think that's emblematic of a really strong thesis and strategy of saying, don't try. He started the marketplace with basically one very narrow product category.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody at the time probably ridiculed him and said, how is there a big enough market for books? But the argument would have been, no, I'll establish the brand that for very good, refined logistics, quick delivery, good customer support, and a plush marketplace with a lot of buyers and sellers. And then I'll continue adding different product categories.
If he did it that way, I don't know. Yeah. We have to ask him next. We have to see on the next.
Him on the podcast.
Yeah, we will. That's a shame. You never know. So when you pivoted to this new role with Scale AI, take us through what is Scale AI doing
now? So most of my team have now, we closed a deal with Scale, and most of my team is now there. What Scale does is it basically builds out AI systems and AI products for governments and for enterprise companies.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be a big telecoms company saying, hey, we're struggling with churn. We think AI can help. So we built a tool that basically analyzes 100,000 calls that come in every day. And we suggest the best next action to the customer support agent automatically using AI that will best route that customer to maximize the chances of retention. Or we've done work with the U.S. Department of Defense and the Army and the White House. We've done work in the Middle East as well. But basically, it's very simple. It's everybody wants to build out AI systems, but they have no idea how to do it.
No one's got any clue.
Yeah. How to make it reliable, how to make it robust, how to make it integrated with.
You go into the company, you research what it is that they need, obviously, how the company works. And then how can AI make it more efficient?
Exactly. Current AI. Their biggest problem. It could be patient triaging or, you know, we've worked with a big healthcare company that's trying to understand.
What about the NHS? Sort it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ambition's there, right? You actually see the cabinet level priorities.
Yes.
Like, hey, let's.
Yeah. Everyone's saying in England, we want England to be the top AI. Are they coming? Are they?
Yeah. I think there's definitely the motivation. There's definitely the excitement and interest. You've seen a bunch of tenders that the government is around some of the priority areas. While you need to see the bias to action, and I think you're seeing more funding flow, or I think momentum build, but the proof still needs to be evidenced. And let's see how the next year or so pans out.
The proof of what? Which proof?
The proof that you'll stand behind the policy and the principles that, even at the cabinet level, that have been talked about. This idea of creating a super house of AI in the UK,
right?
Committing to investing and building out the sovereign AI infrastructure in the UK, where we can really build out not just data centers, but models here and applications. I think it's great that there's the thought behind that.
Let's say you're speaking to a government official, the prime minister sitting here is listening in. What does that require from England to build that up? I mean, if I would be the prime minister, that would definitely be my priority. And I'd say, okay, what does this require from England? I'd rather pump in more money over here because I know in the long term, this will save the country billions.
There are different layers of the stack to think about. And the stack can be the infrastructure or the actual compute layer, which is building out data centers, which is happening. The second layer is building out models, which is like GPT, which is models that they have, or Anthropic or their other companies. I'm not convinced the UK needs to own that layer.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the actual applications and actually adopting.
I think that's what we need, the applications.
Yeah, so I think adoption is key, right? So I think for part of the tenders that they're looking at now, they're trying to revise the process so it's just quicker, faster, more focused on proving abilities that you have from an AI and technology standpoint rather than just the commercial structure or what you've historically done. And I think that's actually the right approach.
Have you worked already on a certain project that you can showcase and say, this is the kind of thing that we've done and we've saved this and we can do the same thing for the NHS or?
Yes, we're actively doing that, but because the government has a very structured procurement process, you mm-hmm. can't just knock on the door and say, you should buy our product tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, a lot of the civil servants would want to do that, but understandably there needs to be a regulated and process. Fair, equitable process for. The question is, can you make that process? Can you go basically from problem statement to tender where you're saying, I have this problem, I want this fixed with AI,
yes.
to decision making?
Yeah.
If you can make that quick, that's what I think matters most.
Correct.
Then you're identifying a concrete problem and you're getting to the state of adoption quite quickly.
Baruch Omer Voseh, blessed is the one that says and actually does it. Yeah, it's nice to put out a statement, we were going to be the AI capital, etc. But it's about that process. And I think it's very, very important. I know a lot of people that would, you know, support, obviously, most of the nation wants to support, unless there's ramifications, obviously there's going to be ramifications for jobs. How do you deal with that kind of thing when somebody comes to you and say, okay, AI is fantastic, but this company that you helped to be much more efficient had to lay off thousands of jobs and now they are, you know, unemployed.
Or if there are automated tools for helping screen and check symptoms for something that you might be feeling with the NHS app or other health AI healthcare apps that are now starting to pop up, you can argue, okay, well, now you've taken out somebody's job that was somebody doing the diagnostics and testing. Yes, but was the net benefit better in that you're able to see more patients and catch things earlier previously?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can make that argument for any new technology. Yes, AI has the potential to create joblessness in wider swaths of society, but I actually still think, and this is me inventing this is a very common idea, that you're going to create new forms of jobs. I still find, I think if you look at the core job, if you ask anybody in virtually any white collar environment today, is there a good 50% of your job which is menial and laborious and you shouldn't be doing and you're not really engaging with your brain, but you're more on repeat and robotic mode, would you say yes? You struggle to find someone who doesn't say that. Booking appointments, filing receipts, filling out forms. All that to me is the blessing mm-hmm. that AI can take over. What does that leave you to do then?